I'm Jeff Cohen. On Saturday to Shabbos, we talk all about people's journeys to Jewish observance. That journey can be spiritual, physical, or both. For Yaakov Shai, the journey took him all the way around the world to China and back to ultimately find his Jewish roots. You might not think of China as the perfect place to light your Jewish flame, but for Yaakov, that's exactly what happened. Yaakov, welcome to Saturday to Shabbos.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm so happy to be here.
And clearly we're going to be talking a lot about worldwide travel as someone who found his way all the way over to China in order to find his Jewish roots, but we're not going to open with that. We'd like to learn a little bit about our guest before we get to the meat of the story. So let's take it from the top. Is there anything about your parents or grandparents that would set some context of kind of your religious background and where your family comes from?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in a conservative shul family and, you know, had bar mitzvah after school, Hebrew school. My parents wanted us to go to there. I think they would have sent us to private Jewish school, but it was not easy financially. So my mother would have pushed for that, but it is what it is. It worked well because I ended up here regardless, I like to say. My great-grandparents all came over from Europe around turn of the century and right around the middle of World War I. Russia, Poland, Austria, maybe a few generations back, Turkey. That's the main geographic history. They weren't religious that I understand, although my great-grandfather on my father's side went to Cheder back in what's now Slovakia in the Carpathians. He was a Talmud scholar, but in terms of observance, they sort of stopped in the States. I'm sure it was very difficult at the time. They had to work. My mother, it said that her grandfather came over with two things. He had a samovar on his shoulder and he had his daughter in his hand. And like, we have the samovar in my house. My grandmother said that her grandmother, so my great, great grandmother, was the only one on her side that stayed religious. I have her candlesticks, actually. She would work really, really hard to send money over for different rabbis and things to come over to the United States. So just, it's great. I have pictures of her too, which is amazing. So,
and then in terms of your family, you said it was conservative. So that can mean different things to different people. So does that mean you're in public school? Are you going to shul? Are you celebrating some of the holidays? Like, what are some of the things going on within the home?
Yeah, so we went to public school. Newton is a very Jewish town, so it's about one third Jewish. We had Friday night dinners. We all had bar mitzvahs and bas mitzvahs. I have an older brother and a younger sister. And I went to Hebrew school 3 days a week. And then in high school, I went 2 days a week, like Sunday and evening. And the main source of the Jewish connection were a couple things. One was we had a group of families who got together right around my birth. We called it a chavara, so we did every holiday together, every major holiday, many school vacations, summer vacations. Like, it was essentially a large extended family of cousins and aunts and uncles. So that was really amazing. That had a big impact.
And when you say you had a bar mitzvah and even went to some kind of Hebrew school or programming post bar mitzvah, do you remember what your feelings were towards Judaism in those teen and high school years?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was mostly bored. I didn't want to go to Hebrew school after school, and I didn't like it. Typical story for conservative shuls. It was just like another thing. My family was super busy with extracurriculars. So, you know, in high school, I would go from wrestling practice to a cappella practice, and then Sundays I'd have Hebrew school, and it was just low on the list of priorities, especially with college pressure. And I was acting up in Hebrew school, especially middle school, and even skipping classes. It was not a good match for me. By the time I was in college, I knew I was Jewish. I was proud I was Jewish, but I wasn't, nothing on the radar saying like, why don't you check out the religious part?
So you just mentioned college. Let's go into those years. Where did you go and what were you studying?
So I originally went to Lewis and Clark College. It's in Oregon. Following my brother's advice, he said, go someplace you'd like to live, which I have mixed feelings about that advice now, but it certainly was beautiful, amazing. I mean, the campus is in the middle of like a state park forest, essentially. It's a gorgeous place. And I was there for 2 years. Jewish life was not even on my radar. I didn't look if there was a Hillel. There's no Chabad. I don't even think there's a Chabad now.
And then you also transfer at that point? You said you did 2 years at the school in Oregon. So what happens after that?
Yeah, so I ended up transferring. I think it was a combination of like, I wasn't sure what I was going to do there. man, it just seemed so expensive to do something where I wasn't sure. So I transferred back to my home state, Massachusetts. And there I ended up doing a combination of a bunch of different fields in this self-design major, which very little application in the work world, but it was sort of philosophy, anthropology, history, mainly those three fields.
Now, I said something in the introduction about you going to China, and I'm trying to piece together why that would happen, because what I'm hearing is a guy who is seeking, searching, philosophical. So that does sound like someone who would be adventurous also. Does that play into this move to go to China?
Yeah, sure. And I think I should mention that I studied Chinese in the first 2 years of college. And I was very lucky that we had an awesome head of the department. He taught the first year class. It was amazing.
Wait, how does a guy from Boston go to Oregon to study Chinese?
Yeah. In high school, we had no context for why we were learning what we were learning. It's like I learned 8 years of Spanish. We never even learned anything about Spanish history, Spain, nothing. And I was at a liberal arts school where you have to take a language your freshman year and sophomore year. I was walking around the tables of the gymnasium selecting courses, which is hard for people to imagine these days with everything online. And so I bumped into this teacher and he said, well, I'm the foreign language teacher. I teach Chinese. I said, yeah, I hated foreign languages. I'm saying that's what I said then. I hated foreign languages. Like I couldn't stand taking Spanish. He's like, well, I was like, but I might just do it again because I already know it. And like, at least I'll just do okay in the class. And he's like, well, you could take Spanish or why don't you try Chinese? And it was just like, okay, I'll do it.
So now let's put this all together. Here we have a guy who's learned 2 years of Chinese. So you've become somewhat proficient at whatever level you've gotten to. And now we're in Massachusetts and you're graduating college. So what's the move that happens after that?
So I was granted a scholarship for a 3-week, all expense paid tour around China at the behest of the Chinese government with about 30, 40 other college students. And it was set up by the State Department. And when I say all expense paid, it was like, I get a call from them. And if I didn't pick up the call, they told me afterwards, like they just would have passed over me. So I called and they were like asking, and I had no idea the context, like, congratulations, you got the scholarship. Do you have a passport? No. Okay. We'll get that taken care of in 2 weeks. And then we'll walk your passport down to the embassy and get the visas set up. They gave us money, like spending money and taxi money. They just gave us envelopes of cash. So it was amazing. You know, it was an unbelievable tour. We got to learn so much about the history. We got to have a great time eating and drinking. And that just kind of continued. Midway through college, I ended up taking a summer and living in Beijing for 3 months. And I wasn't keen about going into language programs. Part of my thinking all the way through why I went to China after college, I just said, well, it's financially stupid. If you paid a college semester's tuition, you could live in China for 10 years, like very comfortably. And I knew enough about language that I said, yeah, I'm not going to get fluent in your classroom. So I'll just not waste my time with other stuff. I'll take these classes. But I really liked the time I spent there studying. I got a very good teacher from a connection and I hired him to tutor me like 2 hours a day, 3 days a week, one-on-one. And we just went through all the grammar that I had to go through to learn it. And from there, I kind of had the structure down. So fast forward, how did I get to China? Well, my background in the philosophy, anthropology, history, I was really looking at like what creates a society. What is the fabric of why is a society the way it is? It just occurred to me, and I think this is the big breakthrough. I was thinking about my roots and I was kind of, you know, think of a convenient way to say like back to the land kind of mindset. And I said, well, I think people that at least know something about where they came from might know how to do some of these things, farm and plant. And where I went to school was a very agricultural area in Western Massachusetts. Not all the connections are a perfect fit, I have to say. Some of it was, but in my head, I said, well, I wanted to become fluent in Chinese and I really wanted to see a society that was still agricultural. And I'd done a bit of travel before I ever went to China. So I kind of understood that I could do it and that I could figure it out along the way. So I said, after senior year, I said, I graduated and I said, well, before I jump into the work world, which we know I'll do for the rest of my life, let me take some time and do something that I've really wanted to do and become fluent in Chinese, which like, if we're thinking about future work, it's a very good skill to have. So it wasn't totally like withdrawn from that aspect. So I went, I decided I would check it out.
I'm picturing conversations with your parents. You've got a kid from Massachusetts who first tells his parents, I'm going to go to college in Oregon. And they're probably saying, why so far away? Why are you going across the country? And then you come back for college and think, oh, we got our son back. He's going to be here. And you're like, oh, I have another announcement to make. I'm going to China. You thought Oregon was far, but now look where I'm going. Like, how did your family feel about these moves?
It was not an easy conversation to have about how I felt about school. I really wasn't sure about the value of it in the first place. And there just wasn't an ability to have the conversations. And I think I went into college not informed well enough, thinking like the part of the purpose, like we're past when the founding fathers went to Harvard to improve their character and learn these very important concepts. Like the purpose to some extent was like, you need to come out. This is to equip you to move on to the next phase of life. And I kept being in college doing all this scholarship. Like I was being told, you know, learn what you want to learn about and find your passion, blah, blah, blah. And I kept thinking, how on earth will this take me and prepare me for the next step? Like, I don't see how it's relevant at all. So I think they had mixed feelings, but I think I wasn't the best moment of Kibbutz Ve'em was just like, you can't really stop me if I want to do this. And I didn't ask them for a single penny. I supported myself the whole way through. So in that sense, they really didn't have much agency over what I did.
Now, the way we set up the interview where I've said you find Judaism in China, I think our listeners will be thinking you land in China and something happens in the first couple months or while you're there that starts this whole journey to Jewish observance. But I feel like what I've learned about you from researching you is it's not an immediate thing. It's not the first thing that happens while you're in China. So take us into like the early part of China and what you're going through there, and then we'll introduce how Judaism starts to come into the picture.
Yeah, sure. So I found a way to connect to some local organizations, really like a local farm, but it was a whole establishment. They kind of did ecotourism. So they'd invite people would stay and have meals, and they had a lot of land. It was run by a Taiwanese guy whose family came from that town originally. And I found a way to essentially do like a work for stay there. I was like, okay, I'll help out. I want to learn about the language. And I stayed there for like 3 months, got to participate in an entire rice harvest. Like, you know, I was walking with 60-pound sacks of unprocessed rice on skinny little rice paddy walls with, you know, essentially wearing like Tom's shoes. Mm-hmm. And I was just exploring. I start to get in touch with new ways of learning. I realized that after academia, I said, wow, you know, I'm learning from, I wrote an article then, but it's just was like a blog, personal blog, and it was called Learning from All Five of Your Senses. And there was so much data coming in, smells, sounds, taste, touch, physical sensations. I realized, okay, there's way more to this than what I thought. And I really enjoyed the work. And I only had my iPhone. I don't know what it was, iPhone 2 or whatever it was. I was like the last person to get an iPhone senior year of college. I resisted and I knew, I said, it's going to change society like crazy. I don't want one. Mom got one for Hanukkah for me. I almost told her to return it. She would have killed me though. And so through that, I was looking on the internet and I came across a professor in Beijing who was doing this stuff where essentially she was working with farmers to collaborate with scientists to find better ways to breed seeds based on both people's knowledge. And I got so excited for it. I just told my friend who lived in Beijing, she was in Beijing. I was a 20-hour train ride in central China on the, near the coast, but not on the coast. I just took a train up to Beijing. And I hunted down her office, which is not easy in Beijing, especially when your Chinese is not as good as it is now. And it was in the middle of nowhere. And I knocked on the door. She wasn't there.
After the whole journey.
She was not there. But her PhD student was. And I said, well, give me something I can read about your professor. She gave me the book she published. I don't remember the name, but I read the book like 5 times in like 3 days. It was amazing. And I followed up and I explained to her my circumstances via email because her email was in the book. And I said, you know, I came by, you weren't there. I really like your work. Can I visit you when you're there? Okay. So my time was finishing up in this work for stay. I went back up to Beijing and we met for an interview. And at the end of the interview, she said, how would you like to work as an intern for us? I was like, whoa, what? Didn't expect that. And the interview was going to do something that I'd been dreaming of doing, which was to go to remote places that are crazy beautiful, and basically do like participant field studies where I'm trying to find out information for this Chinese, it was the Beijing Academy of Sciences. It was like a prestigious place to try to find that information. She's like, yeah, and we'll pay you a small stipend to do that. Believe me, it was very small, but I was like, wow, sign me up. And that's essentially what sent me to the province that I lived in for the rest of China.
See, as you were telling this story, and I'm just thinking about this because I've interviewed people who in their 20s went to China, Japan, India, searching, and they end up getting into meditation or Buddhism. Like, these are things that they want to explore. As you're having this internship and you're getting to know the country better, are you starting to think more about religion, even if it's not Judaism? Like, how is this starting to play into your time there?
You know, not that much. I was interested in spirituality from the idea that not all knowledge is quantifiable. It really wasn't on my radar. I think the process of awakening was the Jewish seed was there. It was there. It was going to grow, but it was going to come out when the situation was right. But I was just blown away by how little academia covered in terms of knowledge that everybody experiences all the time. And so it was a big wake up. I was just like, what else did I miss? And I can kind of fast forward to a short anecdote if it's okay. Probably one of the most like eye-opening experiences was when I was in Bhutan, which is the article I wrote in on Chabad.org. I remember there's this moment we stopped by the side of the road, and Bhutan's a really diverse geographically, geologically. We went from like jungle to like forests you'd see in Oregon, like that different. And I'm looking out of these snow-capped mountains and way in the distance through this like fauna and flora. It's just amazing. And I see on a massive pine tree, I see a monkey sitting in the pine tree. And I was just like, blew my mind. I was like, are you kidding? Monkeys in a pine tree? Like, I mean, you see on videos online and TV, you always see monkeys in jungles and stuff. You don't see them climbing, you know, ponderosa pines. So that, I don't know, all these moments about like the nature of knowledge, I think, was the awakening for me.
So as you're telling these stories, I'm not hearing yet that moment where I would think, oh, Judaism is about to enter into the picture. Like, there's nothing you've told so far that says, oh, and then this Jewish guy comes along and invites me to a class and now things are rolling. So it's seeming like you're doing all this exploration, that which is great. And maybe the time is going to run out in China at some point. You know, maybe you'll come back to the States. But something must have happened while you were there that sort of changed the trajectory of why you thought you were there.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was the end of the internship that I had. I suppose the big event in Bhutan, I mean, and this is what I wrote about in the article, there were moments of reflection in Bhutan. It was an extremely spiritual trip. The purpose of the trip that I was on was to meet at this international conference for ethnobiology, which is essentially looking at how different ethnic groups interact with land and how that actually is quite different and how that shapes their culture and their society. But I was there at the behest of the Chinese government once again, as a sort of like helper to the Chinese team, which was like ethnic groups from the province I lived in. We were with 22 other countries of people and ethnic groups representing, I think, 5 continents, maybe 6. And all of them lived in places where they're in like high altitude farming, mountain communities. The whole trip was unbelievably spiritual. And what I concluded was that there was a difference between being spiritual and living in the spirituality of the culture and the civilization you came from. Even in college, I realized that anything I was going to do had to really come from where things were before, and that it really wasn't authentic. I couldn't really adopt another person's religion. I can't adopt another civilization's culture. The power that a religion gives me, was my conclusion, was only if it was my own. And I've intentionally cut myself off. I haven't sought it out at all. And I was crying at that point. There were tears, and I was just like, it was this big wake up. But I remember thinking as I was living there, if I don't get my hands on some kind of Jewish book, I'm going to go crazy. And that was exactly the point where I found the book that ended up igniting the fire.
So in that moment when you're seeking out the book, what are you hoping to get out of it? I wouldn't think you want this book because you're thinking, I'm meant to be an Orthodox Jew. Like, you wouldn't have taken it that far. You just want to make some kind of connection to understand, okay, what's my story? What's my background? Where do my people come from?
Well, I think I saw all around me, at least in the States, I saw, even at that time, I felt that society was kind of falling apart. that people were lost, people were confused, at least in a college setting, people were lonely. And I really, what the question I was asking, like, how do I survive in the world? I need a foundation of something. And I didn't think I'd become religious, but I certainly thought that our civilization would have the tools for me as a Jewish guy to equip myself to survive in the world.
Okay, so what's the book that you found and what happened after you read this book?
So the book is called The Jew and the Lotus, Total Hashgacha Pratis, the way that it appeared in my life. I looked at the title. I said, well, I'm the Jew and I'm in the Lotus. Oh my God. So I read the book. And what I really think it did, it opened me up and it realized that Judaism could be flexible, realized that Judaism had this integration with what's happening today. It wasn't just this old thing that was dying. It was a thing that was living. And we were the interface between me, my neshama, and what I could learn was essentially what Judaism would be. That's where I came across Hasidism. That's where I started to understand, you know, they talk about the Baal Shem Tov. And I was living in a very beautiful place, very close to nature. Every day I was waking up to the sun, hearing birds, looking at the clouds, like going to sleep very close to a little stream, like very close to nature. And when I learned the insight from the Baal Shem Tov that everywhere is God, it's not just in a book. You can imagine I'm waking up, I'm seeing the nature. It hit me like an anvil. There it is. I've been wondering, where is God all this time? It's right there. It's when the sun rises. It's the colors of the sky. It's everything.
Now, as you've told this story about the book, I can see how this had this really profound impact on you. But at the same time, it would take more than a book to get someone to start taking these steps towards Jewish observance. So I know from your background, there's also a challah story that plays into this as well. So can you just share that with us?
Yeah. So I was, after the internship ended, I was really looking for direction. The Judaism button hadn't been checked off yet. It was a restaurant, a farm-to-table restaurant I was working in. And I was talking to some people that I knew in the town. I was saying, you know, what can I do right now? And she said, I have a friend. He's in a village. He's in a town that's, you know, a little ways away from here. He's a very interesting man. I think you should just meet him. And I went there. And it turned out that he had an intimate connection to Judaism, which I just didn't know. On the last day I was there, he said, hey, would you like to make challah? And it was just such a non sequitur at that point. It's such a juxtaposition. Just like the last thing I would think on earth. It would have been like if some lady came out to me, an old grandmother was like, here's some matzo ball soup. You'd just be like, so it just like blew me away that moment. So we made challah. He had this industrial bread mixer, which in China is much cheaper. Thank God. It's really fun when you have access to what's made in China when you're in China. And we made up this huge batch of dough and we made it. And it was the day I was leaving. We weren't even sure it was going to get finished. And I'm getting in the car to go. I'm sitting in this 14 passenger van and this gentleman who was also part of this collective living, he was a retired Air Force pilot from Taiwan, which like, I have no, how are you allowed into China if that's what you did? But that'll remain a mystery. And he's going to take me. And all of a sudden my friend comes out and he has a bag folded neatly. And he comes by my open down window and he just says, here. And I'm like, what is this? He said, it's the challah. So you're not hungry on the way back. And it touched something it's beyond what I'll be able to ever write in words. And that planted the seeds for when eventually I would finish my internship, finish my summer adventure at my friend's parents' house. I would finish 3 months in Taiwan doing very much similar stuff. What turned into what ended up being our livelihood there was making challah. And before that happened, I went up one more time before I was leaving China. My visa was up. I spent 2 weeks with my friend again. He said, well, do you want to sell some challah? Like, we both were living on shoestring budgets. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, well, I did it one time with this guy from another country. And we made some money. We made like cash. So I made a couple times the recipe. And I made like a combination of like a sweet challah and a chewy challah. And we made a whole batch of them. We didn't have any way to transport it. My friend was like, hey, how about that wheelbarrow? He called a cart. And he said, oh, and how about that wooden plank? We can make like a sign on paper. and we'll go out and have all the kids from the homeschool who helped us make it and decorate and paint it and all the parents. And we went out and it sold out in a half an hour. It was like hand over fist. And so we were like, well, that, wow, we should do that again. And that evolved. I left for 3 months. And I remember very distinctly what my friend said to me right before he left. He said, don't stay away for too long. There's still a lot of things to do together. And like, he really did have lots of other things we would do together. And one of them was what became a business for a few years.
So as I'm listening to your story, I'm piecing it together. This guy who's in China, you've got a challah story, you've got a Jewish book story, and at some point your time in China is going to end. So there's been these like roots of re-looking at Judaism, and it's probably hitting you in a different way now as a young adult than it did when you were a kid going to Hebrew school, where you mentioned you were kind of turned off by it. So what happens as the China time is winding down that your interest in Judaism really accelerates beyond this amazing experience of the challah and the book?
So I, at a certain point in China, I actually left to go explore being a Chinese-speaking tour guide in Israel. What would have been really logical is that I ended up at Eisha Torah or Mayanot, and like, right, I met some guy at the Western Wall, and that would be how most of the stories ended. Israel didn't really wake me up. I was so immersed and focused on China and convinced that it had these dimensions of knowledge and reality that I couldn't get anywhere else. I went to Israel. I did the tour guiding thing for 6 months. I really didn't enjoy it. You get to do the fun touring part, but most of it is like logistics, planning and schlepping luggage and making sure everybody's fed and blah, blah, blah. It was not my cup of tea, no pun intended, because we're talking about China. And the only thing I concluded from that was that I wanted to go back to China. But when I went back to China, I needed something to root me because I didn't go back to the community that I was in. I sort of had this feeling, I said, you know, if I stay in this community, I'm never going to leave and I don't know where it's going to go. And I don't think it's really going to go anywhere besides doing what I'm doing here. And that didn't jive with me. So I moved to the city where I hadn't lived ever, but it was just basically me. I found an apartment, true to form, still very isolated from Westerners in this little village. But I needed something to ground me. And I started to like read Chabad.org. I did read Chabad.org a lot when I was in China and I was listening to some Jewish podcasts. So I was taking in and I managed to schlep back and forth hundreds of pounds of books on Judaism, which I can tell you when you're living on a shoestring budget and your average travel time is 3 days rather than 12 hours, it was exhausting. And at that point, I connected up with an amazing Tai Chi teacher. He's like top 10 in China, really. He was great. He's truly a teacher. Like he knew how to break apart someone and just like get them to let go of some of their ideas. And it wasn't like a philosophical thing. It was over drinking tea for 3-4 hours, talking about politics, philosophy, like love, martial arts, history, everything. It was in Chinese though, mind you, he didn't speak a lick of English. So we're sitting there. And, you know, I mean, going out to big meals and practicing martial arts, it's just had a ball together. You know, lots of Verbrengens in a Chinese sense. That's where I kind of feel like I tell people, like, I kind of got my Verbrengen fill. Like, I had enough of those. I was ready to move on. And slowly but surely, it just started to dawn on me that as much as I learn about Chinese philosophy, on many levels, it's incompatible with Jewish hashkafa and halakha. It wasn't like I could find this middle ground. I remember distinctly thinking, I can only bend so far, but I can't break. And while I was in China, I did start to like keep Shabbat in my own way. I didn't go out. I would just spend Shabbat reading Chabad.org. I'd light candles. I'd try to prepare my food in advance. Before I went back to China, again, I felt I really needed something to ground me. I remember I went to the Israeli bookstore and I bought 3 pairs of tzitzis. It's like totally random. Like there's not really a logical explanation, but part of the way through, I started wearing them and I started wearing them to the Tai Chi class. And I remember my teacher like poked fun at me. He's like, what, you have tails sticking out of your shirt. Like what's going on? But he was like, he thought it was great that I was getting back into my own like culture. He was like, keep going. I was like, yeah, people grow beards. He's like, yeah, go for it. And they'd be like, you should grow a longer beard. I think you should have it down to your stomach, like things like that. What really sealed the deal, though, was I was there and I knew a little bit about some of the laws of Judaism, and as you are as well, I assume by your last name, my family comes from Kohanim. And I just said, I'm not going to break the line. I can't. And so I kind of finished, I got my fill of what I wanted to learn about medicine and philosophy and Tai Chi. I mean, I still carry it with me every day. I do. I mean, I think about the stuff I learned there every day. It informs me. But I went home, and pretty much from that point, I decided, you know, I would start observance. It wasn't like all at once, of course, like all of us that are Balchuvas, but I just started. At first I was staying by my parents, then I moved out, and then I moved to a Jewish neighborhood, and bit by bit, layat layat, as you know, we say in Hebrew, and man man lai, as we say in Chinese, I started adding things to it. Although I discovered, contrary to what I learned being kind of an anthropologist in China, there was no way to be an anthropologist in an Orthodox community. It was like I had to actually undergo the change myself. I couldn't just be an observer. And so fast forward, you know, I found a wonderful community. People that are really, that's why I love my shul. People are trying to walk the walk. I loved the community. Concerned about you and realistic about things in life and in touch with the realities. They've all seen hard times. I mean, they came from Stalin, Russia, which is a hell. I love the people there. They invite, I eat by Shabbos. I still do. I eat by Shabbos at the two rabbis' houses for every meal. They would text me and say, you know, they'd ask me if I'm coming. If I said no, they're like, what are you, like, we don't understand. Why are you not coming? Or as another one, it's like, you're always welcome at my table. You don't have to ever ask. If you're shy, just tell us, but like, you're always welcome here. And that, I really needed that, you know, I really needed that warmth and that love. And that, I think, is what ultimately kept me going. And I just saw that the more I got into it, I measured myself by, I actually measured myself by this metric. If as I'm becoming more religious, my relationships with my parents should improve just by the fact that we have that in the Torah. And I held myself to that. It didn't happen initially, actually, for like a year or two. But when I saw that it truly did, and I was really working to make it change, and they became what were not always easy relationships to what I would say right now is very good relationships, I was just like, this stuff works. I was already convinced. I was already in my neshama. I was already saying, I really buy into this. But when I realized, like, look what it does, it's just like, you can't go back. I made a really hard effort to have a social life, to build up friendships, to seek out people. Like I would talk to people who are in their 60s to learn about, you know, they have successful families. I would only want to talk to people that had successful families, were living a Jewish life, really knew how to do it. And I'd make friends with them. I wanted to be around them and learn everything I could or get tips from them. And I tried to eat well and diet and blah, 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 exercise and, you know, go to get my head straightened out and things like that. And it was definitely giving me a place and a very profound sense of belonging and connection, which I think that's the most important part.
And speaking of relationships, so this is literally breaking news that you just got engaged?
My colleague's going to kill me. the entire world's going to know. I'll keep our names private, but yes, I proposed to her 30 minutes before this past Shabbos.
Wow.
So we had our whole first Shabbos, which was wonderful. That was ultimately what brought me home from China. I said, I want to live a Jewish life. An authentic Jewish life is raising a Jewish family, marrying Jewish. I didn't know if it would be religious at that point. But now, you know, my opinion is, you know, that's where the rubber hits the pavement with everything you learn. So that's kind of where it brought me to today.
So first, let me say Mazel Tov. And I know that story will start to unfold as you make it more public. I want to ask you one last question before we wrap the interview. You said that when you were coming back from China, you had this idea in your head that you were not going to break the line. And to me, that could have just meant I'm going to commit to marrying somebody Jewish, like, because that way I can have a Jewish family. It's really remarkable that to you that meant going all the way into Orthodox Judaism when it really could have been enough to just say, I'll find a nice Jewish girl, we'll get married. So it must be something to do with all that time you had in China where you were seeking, searching, looking for authenticity that you came to the conclusion that it's not just about having a Jewish wife. I want to go all in on what I perceive as the right way to follow this religion. Is that an accurate assessment?
Not quite.
Okay, good.
Which I hate to tell me.
That's fine. But, that's why I'm asking.
No, what I meant by that was that I think it comes back to the Kohanim thing. I just feel there's like this intenseness. Even with my seeking in China, it was very kind of rugged and individual like experience. It wasn't like I wanted a communal thing. And like when you think about serving in the base of Mikdash, like it's a very intense, you're like in the presence of God, you know, working. But essentially what I meant was it completely disqualified marrying anybody that was Chinese, that, you know, wasn't Jewish from birth somehow, because we can't. And I just decided that I didn't want to blur that line, because that's something I couldn't undo, right? There's a lot of tshuva and there's a lot of things we can ameliorate the effects later on. But like by Orthodox law, if I marry someone who's not eligible as a kohen, it's a big deal. It can be a big mess. And I was like, no, I'm thinking my great grandfather, I've heard all these stories of my grandfather, who I've heard all these stories, well, I've heard all stories from, you know, and like, and I'm reading his story where it, you know, he's like, my father was from this town and he lived here and his father was from here and his father was from here, all the same place. And it says, and their great grandfather, great, great grandfather was, oh, about from Turkey, somewhere in a neighborhood that we're not sure where it is. And it was like, I'm going to break all of that. And I was learning martial arts with people who either had direct link to the actual people that founded the martial art like 600 years ago. And it was like passed through 11 generations to get to me. And I'm just thinking this transmission of knowledge is super important. And either you get it from the source or you're getting it from a secondhand place. And everything in China told me, because I went to China to see things from the source, was that I had to go and find what I needed from the source itself. I couldn't substitute anything. And I think that's ultimately what led me back.
And that's what I love about your story is here we have a kid from Massachusetts who goes all the way to the other side of the world to ultimately come back to the place where it all started, but as a completely different person. Is that not the definition of someone who goes on a journey? So Yaakov, I just want to say thank you for joining me today on Saturday to Shabbos.
Thank you so much.
Saturday to Shabbos is produced by Gary Wallach. Our theme music is by Paul Uden. To learn more about us, please visit tachlismedia.com. That's tachlismedia.com. Tell us what you think about what you've heard, or suggest a story we should know about by emailing shabbos@tachlismedia.com. I'm Jeff Cohen. Thanks for listening. Please check with us often for more stories of inspiring Jewish journeys. Saturday to Shabbos is a Tachlis Media podcast.